This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist Network News.
We're the moon and paper stars. We lay on the way to Mars. We lay on the way away.
It's September 23rd, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jendo Huang. And we've got a great podcast for you this month.
Yes, we do.
Cheryl Kirschenbaum and Chris Mooney, who are co-authors of the recently released book, Unscientific America: How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. They're going to be speaking with editor of the Humanist magazine, Jennifer Bardi, about the challenges that our society faces by scientific illiteracy and some of their battles with the new atheists. But before we get to that, we are going to start with a letter to the editor that Jess will be reading from a listener. So Jess, take it away.
All right. This is from Jerry from Springfield, Ohio. And he wrote in response to last month's show, I started listening to this podcast tonight and thoroughly enjoyed the first two segments, one featuring P.Z. Myers and another featuring a high school student who had started a secular pinky swear movement as a fun-poking alternative to religious-based abstinence pledges in schools. But then it presented what I can only describe as a diatribe against prostitution and the notion of legalizing it. It was abhorrent to hear this from an organization that otherwise values the power of logic because the speaker's assumptions made no more sense than the creationists that we all rightly criticize. Do I support exploitation of women? Of course not. But this speaker makes the assumption that all women who are in the sex trade are being exploited, that none can be going into prostitution of their own free will, that any effort to legalize or legitimize prostitution will make the exploitation worse. And she doesn't stop with prostitution. She promotes the theory that men who turn to prostitutes are inspired by pornography. So therefore, again, all women who take part in the creation of pornography are being exploited as well. Now, this is important. I do not deny that some, probably most, prostitutes are being exploited. But I submit that, at least in part, its legality is part of the problem. Prostitutes usually have to rely on pimps in order to avoid being arrested. And because they are already living underground, they often get caught up in the drug trade. And their need to feed their habit leaves them open to further exploitation. If they're subjected to abuse from their pimps or johns, they can't turn to the police for fear of being prosecuted themselves. I found it interesting that the speaker cited a survey of workers at a legal brothel in Nevada, which found that 87% wanted to escape the prostitution business. Okay, let's assume that's true for the sake of argument. But what about the other 13%? Should they not be allowed to hold a job that they enjoy? I'd also like to see how the questions in that survey were worded. I know that if someone were to ask me, in my last 2 years of employment in the newspaper business, if I wanted to find some other way of making a living, I'd say, hell yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised to find a majority of my coworkers answering the same way. But does that mean we're being exploited? How many businesses would become illegal based on the majority of their workers not enjoying their jobs? I really try to be a feminist, but to me, that includes the belief that women should be free to make money any way they see fit. And I'm sick to death of feminists who assume that anything that creates a business out of sexuality must automatically be degrading or exploitative of women.
So yeah, that was a letter to the editor in response to Norma Ramos's acceptance speech that we aired on last month's Humanist Network News. And just like at the conference, I think her talk was, I guess, the most controversial in some ways. I don't think what she was saying was necessarily that controversial, but I think a lot of members definitely come from a different point of view in terms of issues relating to pornography and right. The sex trade and all that. So right. I'm glad we got a letter. Jerry, thanks for writing.
Absolutely. And folks, if anyone wants to reply to that or respond to that or any other matter, please feel free to send us an email. You can do that through a form on our website, which is AmericanHumanist.org/HNN, or you can just send us an email at HNN@AmericanHumanist.org. All right, Jenna, moving right along, let's jump into this segment on Unscientific America. Let's give a little background on the co-authors. First, Cheryl Kirschenbaum is an associate at Duke University and obviously co-author of Unscientific America. She holds two master's degrees in marine biology and marine policy from the University of Maine, and she helped to found the Science Debate 2008, which encouraged candidates to debate science research and innovation issues on the campaign trail. She also worked as a legislative science fellow on Capitol Hill, where she was involved in energy, climate, and ocean policy.
And Chris Mooney is a 2009-2010 Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT, as well as being a co-author of the book. He's also authored two other books, The Republican War on Science and Stormworld. So Chris was a visiting associate at the Center for Collaborative History at Princeton, and he's a contributing editor to Science Progress and a senior correspondent for the American Prospect magazine. And he's also one of the co-founders of Science Debate 2008. And the two of them together are actually, they co-blog, I guess is the term, at their blog called The Intersection, which is at Discovery Blogs.
Jennifer Bardi spoke with Cheryl and Chris about their book on Scientific America, about their controversy with the new atheists, and about the role of science in America and how to popularize it with the masses. And Jennifer caught up with them earlier this week.
I'm Jennifer Bardi. I'm the editor of the Humanist magazine, and we are listening to Humanist Network News. Joining me today are the co-authors of the new book, Unscientific America: How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris Mooney and Cheryl Kirschenbaum are joining me. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Good to be here.
Now, the book has probably garnered the most attention for its section on the new atheists and their aggressive approach to casting science in opposition to religion. However, and certainly we'll talk about that section, but I really want to talk about some of the other ideas the book deals with. When we do talk about scientific illiteracy, what exactly are we talking about? Is it a lack of understanding about the way science is conducted or the way it's funded? Is it a gap in knowledge about basic biology and chemistry?
Well, for the purpose of this book, we weren't as focused on, all of these quizzes you hear about where people are, don't recite the right facts that they're asked to remember from elementary school, like whether an electron is bigger than an atom or how long does it take the Earth to go around the sun. So, I mean, those are embarrassing statistics, and, it would be great if the American public could do a better job at remembering them. But we're really a lot more interested in a society where the public is more engaged in science, in what it is, in why it matters, and in how it affects all of our lives. So that's really what we're talking about in Unscientific America.
And you do detail some of the ways in which the public's attention to science is in steep decline. And you characterize some of the underlying problems, talking about corporate media's marginalization of science, of course, the ongoing divide over science and religion. And also, the larger American culture that chooses to disengage from serious topics. And I think, as you write, even glorifies dumbness. Can you talk a little bit first about how the media conglomeration has affected science?
Basically, we've had dramatic changes in the nature of the media starting, they're about 3 decades old. So we single out Carl Sagan as a kind of hero of science communication, but he was dealing with a very, very different media system. And you had a lot of different media outlets being bought up by just a few major corporations, so that you had publicly traded companies cutting costs and, reducing various kinds of coverage and focusing more on things that make lots of money and demand a lot of eyeballs, and so often science wasn't treated as part of that. You had the growth of cable, so the splitting of the media audience into smaller and smaller groups because there's more and more channels, so that science became less a regular part of the media diet. And then you had the internet, which sort of splits the baby into a gazillion more pieces and makes science even less part of the diet of everyone.
There's this Pew Research Center study that came out in July that they conducted jointly with AAAS, with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The American survey, 2/3 of them say they regularly do watch TV shows or channels about science, such as Nova or Discovery Channel. This seems like pretty good news.
Yeah, I don't know that. I know the survey. I don't know that particular finding, but I mean, two-thirds of Americans are watching these programs regularly because then they'd be the most popular shows on television, I think. Everybody's probably seen a nature documentary once or twice. But I mean, there's a lot of evidence to show that people are not deeply engaged. And in fact, the same survey has this really incredible statistic where they've asked the same question a decade earlier in this year. So in 99 and 2009, and they asked people, what do you think are America's greatest achievements? And they found that in 99, 47% of people in America thought that scientific achievements were among our greatest achievements. And that dropped 20% to 2009. And so it's not just 27%. Similarly, it used to be 18% said that landing on the moon was our greatest achievement. And that dropped down to 12%. So there's a real change in terms of thinking about how central science is to the American identity.
Poll after poll, people are still interested in embracing science, interested in the ideas of science. But what's portrayed on television, what's portrayed on film, doesn't always reflect kind of a human side to what science is about. It's often these stories that hype up the scary factor or either misconstrue or overstep what the scientist is trying to say. So in turn, that turns a lot of people who would otherwise want to engage with the media who are actively involved in the research from wanting to move out beyond the ivory tower, from wanting to, you know, look like they're popularizing and therefore, you know, might come off poorly to their colleagues.
And thinking about the media, there is just a difficult situation, the relationship between science and journalism. I mean, it's difficult. And I think you guys do a really nice job in the book of laying that out. I just wanted to read this section. You say, although they're broadly united by a search for the truth, the practical ways in which scientists and journalists pursue that end vary widely. Media coverage tends to be episodic and event-driven, always in search of the dramatic and the new. In contrast, science is an ongoing process, at times exciting, but mostly dull and monotonous, frequently characterized by false starts and dead ends. Now, that's a tough bridge to gap. What do you guys suggest? I mean, is the media, does the media better cover science in other countries? Is there a model we can look to?
I think that we really have to convince media executives, who are the people who matter, large networks, that science still can be entertaining and engaging to the mass public. And it doesn't have to be just sort of an area that's only for a certain group of people that are interested. It's just how you do it. And, you know, it's important that science not be a snooze. And it's important that science coverage be entertaining, be engaging, be surprising, and really make you think about where things are going. So I think that in some sense it's been given up on a little bit too quickly. And I think to some extent science journalists themselves went in for what the scientific community wanted sometimes in terms of covering things in a more technical way that didn't necessarily engage the broadest audiences. So we need to rethink that too. But I think the central thing here is to convince the remaining press that it is not bad for your program, for your ratings, to be featuring science.
Right. It would be interesting, going back to that Pew survey, to find out what people actually thought they were watching when they say they're watching these science programs. But, you know, you guys do talk about the way science is portrayed in the media, but also in film and movies, in sort of, you know, the popularization of science. What do you think are some positive examples of science in film, in Hollywood films?
Well, definitely Contact. I mean, Contact was a film where Jodie Foster portrayed a person who you could relate to, who was dealing with some of the same problems that I think all of us do, and who you kind of root for and see as this multidimensional character. But most of the time, we see the opposite on film and in Hollywood, and it's a scientist who's a jerk and who's Dr. Evil out to destroy the planet, or who's just totally socially inept. And that matters because that's informing a good percentage of the public about who scientists are. I mean, when the public's polled, I think it's like 18% of people say they personally know a scientist. So the way that the public perceives scientists and the way that trickles up into, you know, government decisions and beyond, policy decisions, funding decisions, is being heavily influenced by an industry that isn't really hard at work putting sort of this human face that we can all recognize on science, which is treated in many ways as a special interest group to begin with. And obviously Hollywood is about film, is about entertainment. But in some ways, I think if we had more people involved with the experience, with the background, and the know-how, we could tell even more compelling stories in a lot of the cases. And we have the National Academy Science and Entertainment Exchange that I think is a real effort to try to get there. And that started just last year, but it's created by the National Academies, and it's a kind of forum, really, directed by Jennifer Ouellette, to make these conversations happen, to get filmmakers more comfortable talking to scientists in the specialty that they're interested in, and vice versa, scientists who have a story, sort of getting it out there in a way that more people can hear about it.
You use the term in your book, Renaissance scientists, I think, to talk about this idea of kind of encouraging this, you know, these scientists who are out there in the culture, kind of mixing it up and appealing to the masses at the same time, who have a really, you know, pretty solid, deep understanding of the actual content rather than just the controversy or the, you know, the importance of science in our culture. And it reckons back, and you guys talk about this in the book, to C.P. Snow's lecture 50 years ago about the two cultures. And back then it was scientists and intellectuals who were apparently at odds and whose inability to communicate would prove to be detrimental. So if you guys are kind of in a way encouraging not the third culture, but these Renaissance scientists who really can do it all, what is the actual plan? How is this going to be? I mean, in addition to this program that you already mentioned, you talk about this a lot in the book. How else do you see this developing?
I think that we're seeing more and more young people looking for new opportunities to expand what they're doing in science. Not everyone certainly has to be another Carl Sagan, but the odds of someone graduating right now with a PhD going on to land a tenured faculty position is only 7%, according to the National Postdoc Association's last sort of information polling fact sheet. So there's a lot of people with a tremendous amount of expertise and skills who are, you know, capable of broadening the discourse, broadening science's influence on society by being, you know, a scientist who can also be a good public speaker, who can also write, who can also speak another language. And there's more and more opportunities for these people, and there's more and more places for these people to really work and explain what scientists are doing and how it affects all of us. We've seen more and more applications to a lot of these congressional fellowship programs, like I did, where a scientist will go on to Capitol Hill and work in a Senate office, a House office, work in some of the executive agencies at communicating why what we're all working on affects policy, how it affects policy, how these decisions matter beyond sort of what politicians and their constituents are used to hearing about. So there's opportunities like that. They're taking the stigma off of sort of going a non-traditional trajectory. And then there's also possibilities for new programs. Like, I mean, Chris and I would love to see something like a science corps for young students interested in science after college to be able to go out and work in communities on science sort of on the ground at the local level, whether it's in local politics, whether it's for a local newspaper, all these different things that we already see through opportunities like AmeriCorps, but directed toward a science-interested segment of the public.
Cheryl amply documented there's all these young people out there with tons of expertise and no faculty positions for them. Mm-hmm. So the plan is to get the philanthropic university community and so forth to recognize that there needs to be the creation of a wide range of transitional positions for them so that they can go and use that to bring science into contact with society. So, you know, currently they're, you know, if they don't get the academic track and they've got to go into corporate America, or there might be some number of fellowships and things that they can do. But we're saying there needs to be a whole new range of options that are publicly oriented, and that can bring science back into touch with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I know that I used to work at the Scripps Research Institute in California, and, you know, of course there was this glut of postdoctoral students, and they were just kind of bouncing around, not knowing what they were going to be doing. And a lot of them would express an interest in science writing or, you know, science media, but just had no idea where to turn. You know, it seemed that their path had already been kind of set for them. And if they weren't willing to sit at the bench for the next 10 years, then, you know, there was just no option. So I think, you know, there's certainly an audience out there that would be thrilled, you know, to see some funding going towards these types of programs.
I meet people at Duke. I mean, there's some postdocs at Duke who come and find me practically every week and say, how do I get into writing? You know, what did you do? Where can I learn these skills? Mm-hmm. And then there's more and more kind of piecemeal groups popping up on campus here and probably at universities across the country to hone a lot of these skills. And we're seeing, you know, more and more applications going in for the IGERT program, the the integrative graduate research training that incorporates, you know, all different disciplines into a PhD program. So you're learning law and you're learning socioeconomics and you're learning a lot of different policy skills too that are going to prepare you to move your PhD beyond beyond academia into other arenas. We're seeing the rise of blogs at universities. Duke, in just the time that I've been here, has been encouraging students more and more each year, each summer, to get involved, to get writing, just to get practicing. So I'm optimistic that that the environment is changing and what's acceptable for students interested in science to do beyond their research is changing too.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned science blogging, and I definitely wanted to touch on this. In your book, you refer to it kind of as the Wild West, and maybe Chris, you could talk about, you know, maybe some of the main problems and also the potential that you see in the blogosphere for science.
Clearly, whatever form science communication takes in the future, and nobody's exactly sure, quite a ton of it is going to be web-based because that's the way that everything's going. And that is just to state the obvious, and we have data showing you people who seek to learn about science are increasingly indeed going to the internet. And we also see that as science journalism is declining in the traditional press, science blogging is booming. So it's very important to understand precisely how science is being conveyed in this world. And unfortunately, as someone who has been, I'm among the first generation of science bloggers. I started in 2003 when blogging about science was still something of a new thing. And I've watched it evolve, I've watched it grow, and I think that there's wonderful content there, but there's also a lot of problems. And first of all, there's tons of misinformation on blogs that masquerade as being about science, but in fact they're not. They're centrally dedicated to attacking science. You've got anti-global warming blogs like What's Up With That. You've got anti-vaccine or vaccine skeptic blogs like The Age of Autism. You've got, you know, anti-evolution blogs. And those things are popular. So nobody is debunking that stuff doesn't make it go away on the internet. In fact, the internet is a place in which it's able to thrive. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, if you go over to, quote, our side of the blogosphere, which is where the defenders of science and reason are supposed to be, to some extent, yes, they're there. But you also find a sort of hive-minded thinking, and you find what I consider a lot of extremism and even, you know, some anti-intellectualism in terms of the constant attacks on religion that occur there. And I think that it's actually become an environment in which there's a ton of groupthink. So we're uncomfortable with that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in one sense, that's a fundamental challenge of trying to move away from so much intellectualism and trying to appeal to the masses, right? I mean, then you're going to be giving them what they want, which in most cases seems to be this kind of extreme controversy. I thought it was really telling that you talked about the Web Awards. You know, it was this race between what did you call it? What's Up With That climate deniers site. And then of course, PZ Meyer's site were sort of going head to head for the top blog. I mean, what does that tell us? This is what people are drawn to.
Yeah, but I would add, though, that in the context of all the information that people are consuming, this is what people in the science blogosphere are drawn to, two extremes. But the readership for both is only an incredibly small slice of what everybody's consuming, and most people are not getting either. And most people would probably be turned off by and uninterested in both.
That's a general criticism of blogs. And I mean, it's a criticism of blogs in general. I mean, people, it devolves into a lot of bickering and kind of, in some cases, opinion based on nothing other than the comment before it. So
science journalism, you know, I mean, I feel this really strongly. I'm in a science journalism program at MIT now, which is a fellowship where science journalists can take a year off and sort of try to improve their craft. And a lot of soul searching is going on in terms of what that craft is going to look like. But I've been in it for a while, and you get a lot of people who've been working on science journalism in newspapers for a while, and these are the jobs that are being cut. And I got to say, you contrast the way they cover science with the way some blogs cover science, and you just find the science journalists, because they come from a newspaper background where there's really a craft, or a television background where there's a craft, there's a set of norms, you have to go through a process, you have to learn various things about the way it all works. There's a much different and much more elevated set of standards, mm-hmm. in terms of how you treat information and the canons of civility and, you know, calm discourse that you employ. All of these things are not things to be discarded lightly. They exist for a reason.
I absolutely agree. What about websites like Eureka Alert, you know, like AAAS's website? I mean, that seems like, I mean, it's obviously not a blog, but they seem to do a really good job of popularizing, you know, specific research that's just being reported. What can be done with sites like that? I mean, do you think these can be marketed to the public more aggressively?
Yeah, I mean, I think Eureka Alert is good. It sort of falls in the category of, you know, the web version, to me, the web version of science. The web version of nature. You know, it's a lot of press releases about different people's work. What worries me about that is that it's, you know, it's extremely good information, you know, no accuracy problem,
right,
or anything like that. And it serves a particular audience. But I think that when you talk about something like that, when you talk about any science publication, that's a science magazine or a website like that, what you're talking about is something that reaches the knowledge rich. In other words, the people who already know about science, mm-hmm, care about science, that are interested in science. And we really need to have a lot of organs serving them, and it turns out that we do. And there will always be, I think it will always be profitable to have magazines that are about science geared towards the people who care about science, because they're large enough to sustain these kind of publications. But these kind of publications max out in terms of the audiences they can reach, and the way in which they treat the scientific information is often in such a way that for a general member of the public doesn't know a lot about science, it's at too high a level. So you need something else for everybody else. And I think it's that we're losing.
Yeah, I was surprised you guys didn't mention Neil deGrasse Tyson much, well, at all in the book. I mean, he's kind of seen sometimes as inheriting the mantle, Carl Sagan's mantle. I mean, certainly Nova Science Now is entertainment based. I mean,
I really like Neil deGrasse Tyson. I actually worked with him during one of my early research experiences for undergraduates back when I was in my early 20s, and he influenced some of my interests later on to kind of, you know, allow me to do something different. So yeah, I certainly think he's terrific, and he's been very active in the Science and Entertainment Exchange that we were discussing earlier.
Oh, great. Okay. We'll let him know. He accepted an award from the American Humanist Association back in June and sort of, you know, dazzled the crowd. So I'm sure our listeners will be glad to hear that. Now, speaking of our listeners, I wanted to switch gears just a little bit. You use the term humanists in the book to refer, in the section about the two cultures and so forth, you use humanists to refer to intellectuals who were at odds with science back then, and also to characterize kind of the postmodernists of the 90s as humanists. Now, how do you reconcile this with the definition of humanists as non-religious progressives who are very much a part of the academic left and champions of science, if not scientists themselves?
Oh, well, there are many definitions of humanist. I mean, there's one sense in which this is people in the humanities and as opposed to people in the sciences. And so when we were using it there, we were talking about the 1990s wars between science and the humanities. And of course, C.P. Snow's two cultures dichotomy is about science and the humanities. So that's one form of humanist. And I fully recognize that there's also a humanist movement, which is about an ethical, non-religious lifestyle. And that's actually, I'm in both senses, I'm a humanist. So there's just different uses. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to put down one or anything like that.
No. I mean, I think most people know the distinction. I had to ask since we're on the Humanist Network News. I did think the discussion of postmodernism was interesting. I mean, at this point, does it almost seem sort of poignant that there was this war between the humanists per se and the scientists?
Yeah, we think it's just, you know, I mean, the battle's over now, and it's weird. People barely talk about it anymore. And
yeah,
this was like the biggest thing in the 90s by far. And in retrospect, you just scratch your head and like, well, was that what we were focused on? Because look at, you know, all the other problems facing science. And was that ever really that big of a threat? Mm-hmm. And my answer is no.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for someone like myself, who was a comparative literature major in the 90s, it was, I mean, you know, I was only too glad to see the postmodernists could leave.
Oh, I hated it too. I was in an English department, and the reason I wanted to learn more about science, I didn't become a science major, but I started taking science and philosophy classes and so forth, was because I've been really turned off by some of the stuff in the English department and some of the stuff in film studies, which I was also interested in. And so I was like, what is this? You know, I can't understand this. This has, you know, sort of really jargon-strewn academic papers. And so yeah. It turned me off as an undergraduate. I think it probably did that to a lot of people. It didn't do the humanities any good. But whether it was a giant threat to science, I don't buy that either.
This is Rabbi Binyamin Biber of the Society for Humanistic Judaism, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang. And you are listening to an interview with Chris Mooney and Cheryl Kirschenbaum, who are co-authors of the new book, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And in this segment, the two co-authors talk about the controversy with the new atheists, and this is where the gloves come off.
That's right, Jenda, round one. Ding.
The chapter in your book that's titled Bruising Their Religion discusses P.Z. Myers, who, of course, is the 2009 Humanist of the Year. He's a biology professor and a science blogger. Now, you guys just talk about his great desecration stunt. And for listeners who don't know about it, in short, Myers desecrated a communion wafer to support a student who had himself taken a wafer from a campus mass in order to protest student fees going toward religious services at his university. Now, the student received actual death threats. Catholic leaders were calling for his expulsion. And yet P.Z. Myers is the one who's accused of being out of line here. Now, you guys castigate him pretty severely because he's a public figure. And I think in some ways, you know, accurately conclude his assault on religious symbols, quote, does nothing to promote scientist literacy. Now, my first question is this. If you're in favor of scientists as better communicators, shouldn't they be seen as active in the greater world? I mean, in the culture wars, for example, or supporters of the establishment clause, religious freedom, human rights, so on.
Absolutely. I don't think that's the point at issue in terms of criticism of P.Z. Myers or our debate with P.Z. Myers. We need to speak out for, you know, civil liberties. We need to speak out for reason. We can even speak out for atheism. That's a very important thing, too. But you also have to think about what the purpose you're serving is, whether you're advancing the cause or whether you're not, whether you're doing it in a civil way that promotes reason and dialogue or not. And our criticisms of the new atheists are based on two things. One, these kinds of actions that we don't think are in any way constructive and that we think are, in fact, destructive and that just reinforce the bifurcation of the culture war. And also, you know, some substantive criticisms of the ways in which they've lumped a lot of categories of people together, trying to treat religious moderates as if they're as irrational as religious extremists, for example, which just isn't true, and trying to claim that you can't in any way reconcile science and religion, which I also don't think is true. So that's the grounds for the criticism.
So in a sense, it's, you see it as more a matter of style, that their style is just too aggressive?
Well, yeah. So there's the abrasiveness of the style and the questioning of whether that is actually effective or instead whether it sort of reinforces a culture war. And then there is the criticism of the substantive positions. So, you know, for example, when you take the approach that they take to religious moderates and you take someone like a Kenneth Miller, who's a Catholic biologist at Brown, and, you know, you argue with and attack these people who, you know, should be our greatest allies when it comes to advancing common cause of science and reason, then that's a real problem, too.
You know, some of the large science organizations, most of them, AAAS, the National Center for Science Education, take, you know, the long-held position that science and religion are compatible. This isn't a problem. It shouldn't be a problem. Now, interestingly, I'm going to cite this Pew study again because it is recent, and I think it's interesting because it was conducted along with AAAS, and so they surveyed, you know, general public and also scientists. 55% of Americans see science and religion as often in conflict. Now, 64% of them said that if scientists were to disprove a particular religious belief, they would reject the scientific facts in favor of their faith. So clearly, this is a problem. And if you have certain people who are taking a very aggressive response, perhaps there are those like yourselves who can then echo off of that and try to make maybe a milder point. I mean, it clearly that people see this as a problem, that science and religion do not seem to be compatible.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, but the data you cited doesn't show science and religion are incompatible universally. It shows that many people have conflicts between science and religion in terms of what they believe. And that's trivial. I mean, everybody knows that that's the case. If you accept certain kinds of religion that are fundamentalist, that are literalist in terms of how you treat scripture, then you're basically compelled to reject science. But it's not the only option. And so there are other, you know, ways in which you can make science and religion compatible.
I mean, I spent my graduate years in Maine. I was working with very religious communities, very religious fishermen who wanted to work with me as much as possible. But it took a very long time for them to accept me as someone they could even talk to, as someone they wanted on their boat, as someone who wasn't going to just attack them and try to take their fishing rights away and think they're stupid and don't understand anything. Because they had this very perverted view of who scientists are, what we do, and you know, how we are perceived in conflict with everything that they stand for. And it was by breaking a lot of that down and talking to each other as people, going out for a drink after the boat and just hanging out for a while and getting to know each other, that I ultimately was able to succeed and, you know, be on their boats every couple weeks and get the data I needed and not be a threat, but kind of be on the same side in a lot of ways. And the same thing is true for when I worked on Capitol Hill. These are communities that are outside of the bubble that I'm used to being surrounded by, because I've mostly spent my professional career in academia. But these are people who are very, very influential in the world of science without directly being involved and engaged, and are also, you know, in some cases religious. But we need them involved. We need community members involved at every level. And we need them on board. Science needs as many allies as possible. So I think by taking a very abrasive approach, we're turning more people off to ultimately working toward solutions to some of the 21st century's greatest challenges than anything else.
Fair enough. You know, these are scientists who are obviously people in the world who have strong opinions about spirituality and the existence or non-existence of God. Now, these scientists are not just representing, and I guess I'm talking about the new atheists here, they're not just representing the scientific community. They happen to have become real standard bearers for the atheist community. You know, if you look at the number of Americans who are religious, who believe in God, I mean, it's very high in the 80th percentile. Now, among scientists, it's like a third. So in a sense, you know, these are the perfect people to be sort of the heroes of atheists, of humanists, of people who are largely agnostic. And certainly they should be allowed to do so, speaking maybe not always for scientists, but for these non-believers.
Well, I think that, I'm a non-believer, I certainly think non-believers should have role models. I think that whoever, you know, those people are, they should set examples by, you know, showing civility, you know, standing up for a reasoned dialogue, and, you know, and not, you know, lending their positions to basically, you know, extreme denunciations that are categorical, that miss all the nuances of the nature of a religion. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of inaccuracy out there, and I think there's a lot of incivility, and I have a real problem with that in terms of the example that it sets.
I mean, you do have to deal with the popularity of these books. I mean, they're wildly popular. The percentage of the public that is, you know, willing to admit that they're non-religious is fairly small, but, and yet these book sales have been through the roof. I mean, it's clearly touching a nerve. And I think that in some ways it's going to bring people to, for example, Dawkins' new book about evolution. Certainly the controversy, the kind of...
Well, let's talk about a specific thing from Dawkins that I would object to, and we'll just, so you can see what I'm talking about.
Okay.
And why I think this is a problem. Dawkins, you know, in The God Delusion, he says, he talks about people like the National Center for Science Education and Ken Miller and others, you know, people who defend evolution, but at the same time, they are not strongly critical of religion, or else they are themselves religious. Certainly they're willing to work with religion, okay? These are people that I would argue should be our allies. Richard Dawkins calls them the Neville Chamberlain School of Evolutionists. In other words, they're the cowards. They're the ones that give up and stop fighting. I find that really objectionable, because basically that's saying, you know, to these people who are our allies, who we work with, on the defense of evolution. No, you're not our allies. You know, you're actually doing it wrong, and you're on the wrong side. So that's my example of something that's not constructive, that doesn't advance the defense of evolution, and that alienates people who are not enemies of reason in any particular way.
And perhaps, you know, the Richard Dawkins of the world are actually willing to be the ones that are that kind of that extreme in order to allow the less extreme voices to be heard as well. I mean, people pay attention to these kind of messages, whether they agree with them or not. They certainly listen. And so I think that more moderate voices are actually empowered by some of their messages.
Well, that message tells people to attack more moderate voices. I mean, that's what it's saying. It's saying that these people are Neville Chamberlain in our mess. You know, in fact, you know, they're the leading defenders of evolution in America. So I don't see, I don't see how that's constructive.
Well, what I'm saying is that they're voicing a very extreme position because their voices are so loud and actually very compelling. I mean, these are people who write very well and write not only about this topic, but about actual science. They're credible, right? So people are listening to these loud voices. And so some more moderate voices actually can play off that echo is the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I don't see it. I think it squeezes out the moderate voices, but and tells the people, you know, who are more extreme to attack the moderate voices.
Well, I mean, I know what you're saying. I know that, you know, Sam Harris toes that line as well. But I think that there are many people in the humanist community, for example, who they may not actually agree with the tenor. They may not actually agree with the way these arguments are made. But nonetheless, they appreciate the opportunity to then voice their own opinion, not in opposition, but in relation to these extreme views.
Okay, and they'll get attacked, you know. So
well, but it still offers an opportunity to speak about these things. I mean, I think that some people feel that just to ignore it, I mean, it hasn't worked. That the you know people's for, you know we talk about evolution, which seems to be the always the hot button issue. People's ideas about evolution just haven't changed. So you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, how detrimental has it really been if people's ideas haven't changed at all? But is this creating a possibility to continue this conversation rather than just kind of shoving it under the rug?
I just find it very polarizing. Like it's in either you're with us or against us. There's no, it limits the discourse. It limits the people who want to engage at all. And it just leaves the most vocal voices for the masses who are just sort of watching it all from a distance and saying, I don't want to be any part of that.
Well, now you got your book has been criticized for neglecting the anti-science forces. You know, you don't really attack them with the same gusto as you do the new atheists.
I wrote a whole book attacking the anti-science forces. It was called The Republican Wants Science, which is why I didn't want to reinvent the wheel with this book.
I found the reactions just from people that I've, you know, met personally at different book signings and stuff very interesting, because it seems like no matter sort of which arena you come from, whether it's you're working in politics or whether it's you're a very religious person, you're a very non-religious person. A lot of folks seem to think we're harder on whatever side that they support.
Of course.
So I'll oftentimes be having two conversations at the same time with different groups, and they're like, no, you're harder on us. No, you're harder on us. And they're arguing with each other, and I'm just sitting there listening at that point. So.
Right. Now, here's a new question. If a scientist, this is a discovery made, say, in neuroscience, challenging people's religious conviction, I mean, do you think that it's the responsibility of scientists to help them figure out how to integrate that into their faith-based worldview? I mean, what is the role of scientists here?
First of all, I mean, we got to explain what the new knowledge is, and that's a central role for scientists. Mm-hmm. And then some scientists, I think, would be uncomfortable with telling people how, you know, a new finding in neuroscience does or doesn't let you know whether there's a ghost in the machine or not, you know, which is basically what the religious concern is. And so, you know, nobody who feels uncomfortable with it should probably be out there addressing that question. But given, just like with evolution, given the findings in this area are going to immediately strike a lot of people as having large religious implications, I think it would be foolhardy if nobody in science was explaining to people how to think about the science in that context, because that's what people are going to want to know. And that's precisely the reason that a group like the National Center for Science Education doesn't remain silent on matters of religion. It's not because, you know, they really want to take a strong stand on science-religion compatibility, but it's because, you know, that's what people care about. Whenever evolution comes up, it raises all these theological questions for people, and they immediately start asking about them.
Mm-hmm.
So science is better, some science is better be prepared to address the knowledge in that light, or else they won't be able to talk to everybody else.
Right, and I would move from there to saying any knowledge. I mean, in my own field, we have people working on oceans issues that have dramatic implications beyond putting a paper out. And a lot of scientists, you know, weigh whether they need to become, you know, look like advocates or what they should do with the information. Well, if you're working on research that shows the effects of climate change, that, you know, how it implicates what's out there, how our children are going to live in the future, all different issues like that. It would be great to be able to communicate why that matters and get that out there and not just publish it in a journal that very few people have access to and leave it at that.
Everyone needs to acknowledge the fact that we as human beings are not just rational. I mean, we're emotional, we're highly conflicted, complex human beings. And so I think in science, if that can be taken into account, certainly it's going to help. But I think that's a real challenge, though. I think it can be very, very distracting.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, this is the critical, you know, to communicate science, you have to make it relevant to your audience. Well, in these areas where people view the science as having religious implications, you've got to talk to them in that context. Or else you just, you know, you're going to go right over their head or right under their radar. And, you know, you're not going to get through.
I know that there are a fair number of humanists, atheists, who were very nervous about Francis Collins taking over as the director of the NIH. I think he's, he stepped down from the BioLogos Foundation. And I think that was a clear conscious act to try to reassure people that his religious beliefs were not going to be involved. I mean, the mission statement of that foundation is that faith in science can lead to truth about God and creation. You know, and I think that's a dangerous position. I mean, how can science lead to truth about God?
Well, in a theological context, a religious believer might think that the knowledge provided by science gives some sense of the way that God made the world. It's not a scientific view, but I could see how it could be a religious view, and that they would view it through a lens that is their own, that that's some kind of religious truth.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly can't see how it would be a scientific truth. But, I mean, are we saying that it's wrong for people, you know, to use knowledge about the natural world to, you know, come to some kind of religious conclusion for themselves? Because I don't think that's wrong. It's just not something that I do.
Right. No, I mean, I think the danger is to treat, you know, belief in God as sort of an answer in search of questions, you know, rather than looking at science as the posing of questions in the search for answers. I think that the more that science can be popularized, I mean, I think we can sort of ease into these, the difference between those two.
I think people should know the difference. I will say that. I mean, people definitely should know the difference between the scientific way of thinking and a religious way of thinking. But there's so many people in the world, you know, we come from so many different places and so many different backgrounds. If, you know, people know their science and then on top of that, you know, they feel compelled to go farther into some theological realm to set up their personal belief system, and they're not getting the science wrong, then I am really hesitant to judge how they're creating their identity. They're not forcing it on us, right? I mean, that's the key thing is, you know, if this is a violation of church and state, that would be one thing, you know. If this was getting the science wrong, that would be one thing. But what do you do when there's no jamming it down your throat and there's no inaccuracy? It's just a religious belief that goes along with someone's views on science. Do we really want to have that fight?
I don't think so. I think there's a much bigger fight to be had, which is, of course, with the young earth creationists. I mean, who are trying to change, you know, school policy. I mean, that's the fight. And I think that if we can have some of these heavyweights in our corner, you know, in some ways we need to acknowledge them for what they are doing. I know what you're saying. You're saying it's detrimental, but I'm not quite convinced.
Well, we're all for standing up to teach evolution in the classroom. I mean, that's something that I think we've both written about. When it comes to issues like that. But I think we're talking about reaching the broadest consensus on supporting science and well beyond, you know, one specific religion, one specific group or way of thinking. And in that sense, we need to be as inclusive as possible and less, I think, judgmental of people's lifestyles.
Okay, so one final question, and let's you know, do away with the idea that you know, a religious belief is, you know, equates scientific illiteracy. Okay, let's just, you know, move past that claim. The title of the book, the subtitle is How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Now, in a nutshell, if you will, how does it threaten our future?
Well, I mean, we live in a time where we're seeing a warming climate, where we're facing you know, changes in neuroscience and genomics that are going to alter the way that we think about the world. We're working with issues that affect our economy and our standing in sort of a global worldview. And unless more people are going along with us, and we're able to address a lot of these issues in a way that not only scientists are taking seriously, but policymakers are taking seriously, the public is on board with us, at least in enough of a way and engaged enough where they're willing to stand up and support the science that really matters, beyond kind of what we've got now, beyond just kind of hearing it as a side topic on the Colbert Show. We're gonna fail to continue to lead. We're gonna fail to compete with other countries that are really putting their money and their efforts into supporting science. And we're not gonna meet a lot of these challenges and change as quickly as the world around us is.
We think that scientific illiteracy threatens policy in the future. It threatens decision making, sound decision making on science centered political issues. That if we don't handle right, you know, we may not have a future. So global warming is the most obvious, but there's every reason to think that there will be others. So we've been, the 20 years of gridlock on global warming and scientific illiteracy is a central part of the cause, because the media has covered it inaccurately and created the idea that there's a debate over the science. And, you know, half the public doesn't accept the science, and that's why we can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So do we want to keep repeating that incredibly unhealthy pattern? And there's also a very unhealthy pattern on the evolution issue, you know, where we don't get anywhere. Or do we want to find a better way of dealing with these problems? Well, if we're going to deal with them better, then there has to be some change in how we handle science and some change in how science gets from, you know, the pages of the journals into the brains and of people and into the news media and so forth. And clearly we've got to repair that.
Well, and just as a way to wrap up, I mean, I want to thank you both for taking this so seriously, and certainly this is your focus, and I think it's a really, really important one. So I want to thank you guys both for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And that was Cheryl Kirschenbaum and Chris Mooney, co-authors of Unscientific America. And if you want to learn more about their book, you can visit them at their website, which is unscientificamerica.com. And if you want to check out their blog, The Intersection, that is at blogs.discovermagazine.com/intersection.
Cheryl also has a book coming out in fall of 2010. It's going to be called The Science of Kissing. I, for one, can't wait to see what that's about.
Seems like it'll be interesting. So now I guess we've heard a little bit from both sides of the new atheist divide. To be honest, I'm definitely more of a new atheist. I should say I definitely fall more in the realm of the new atheists. I think I'm more sympathetic to them, but hearing Mooney and Kirschenbaum, I was actually slightly more convinced. And I mean, there's definitely a place for like tactics and stuff, but I think with the new atheists, there's a lot of frustration, and it's just to the point where it comes down to the issue is, why are we coddling religious people? Why are we coddling people who are kind of more moderate in their religious belief and who hold, you know, what we consider being irrational, who are otherwise rational, but then hold this kind of irrational belief. And I think there's a lot of, with, you know, Dawkins and P.Z. Myers, I think there's just a lot of frustration and finally a lot of like, why don't you just understand and kind of get over it type thing.
Right. I thought Mooney's point about, he said something to the effect of, if they're not getting science wrong and if they're not jamming it down our throats, then what do we care what kind of opinion they form? What kind of religious conclusion they come to about, you know, creation or God.
Yeah.
I think to me, it's like, how are they not getting science wrong if they're taking, you know, the theory of evolution, and they still believe in God after that, even though I know that Darwin's point wasn't to take away that there's a possible God.
Because I think Dawkins is, you know, someone, and P.Z. Myers too, like, they all come from that point of view where if you fully accept, you know, the theory of evolution purely as a scientific theory, and then you kind of look at the implications for what that means about the origins of humanity and all, it kind of leads you to that conclusion,
right,
of that there just being no proof for an existence of a God. And I think so the issue for them is, you know, why are these people who maybe do understand evolution and accept it to a certain degree, like, I think they see that there's a certain level of what they consider to be like intellectual dishonesty.
Right.
Because why are these Christians, these mainline Protestants and Catholics, not willing to take it the full,
right,
the full way?
But in saying that, I sort of sounded like I also agree with the new atheists, and I don't necessarily. I think that we need as many different kinds of advocates, you know, in the movement as possible. So I guess that would include the new atheists, but I certainly also think that it should include any religious person who is for, you know, for popularizing science and for getting religion out of the classroom. So I guess I like to be the one who doesn't fight with anyone.
Right, yeah. And I think from a tactical point of view, for our movement and the goals that we have, it makes sense to work with as broad of a coalition as possible. But then I think maybe some humanists and atheists are worried that while we're doing that coalition work, we may also kind of forget, too, that even if we work in coalition with people who are religious liberals or moderates and things, in the end, we still have, you know, what can be considered like a fundamental disagreements and fundamental differences with them that,
right,
at some point will, I mean, you know, ideally, maybe in some ideal world, it wouldn't have to be resolved. But I think other people have that more confrontational point of view in saying, even if we work together to kind of, you know, keep creationism out of the classroom and make sure that church and state remain separate, that at some point these other issues are still going to come to a head between us and people who we are willing to ally ourselves with now. And
right. And I think it's kind of a, where do we want to place emphasis on the fundamentals of humanism? Like, is it on the belief or disbelief in God, or is it on, you know, getting religion out of the classroom?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that, we're sort of weakening the cause, though, if we can't even get our act together as a movement to have, like, a united front.
And this is a problem you'd think with, like, the ideals of what humanism represents and stuff, that we'd all be able to kind of be together and move forward in that way. But, you know, really no social movements, I don't think, has ever really truly been that unified when moving forward. There's always, like, a difference with tactics. And
right. I wonder if religious movements have the same problem with so many different religions. They seem to sort of have their act together, though.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, too. It's always, it's, you know, us from the outside looking in. Like, it's funny because, right, you look at some things that Christian, like more extreme Christians, write about the humanist movement, and they see us, you know, as some, like, you know, juggernaut that's just kind of rolling through everything. And, you know, mm-hmm, I think from inside the movement, if you're a member of it, or especially if you kind of really work for it, you definitely get a more complex, nuanced picture, right, than what, you know, what they see. And it's probably the same for us when we kind of look over and see. I mean, yeah, you're right, considering how many religious groups, like how many Christian denominations there are, all kind of doing the same thing, but
right,
with their own little goals. I mean, I'm sure there's weird personality conflicts there, too.
All right, Jenda, well, I guess that about wraps that up for this month.
Yes, it does.
I would love to hear what our listeners think. Which side of that divide do they fall on, or are they, like me, somewhere in the middle? Folks, feel free to email us at hnn@americanhumanist.org and share your thoughts.
And until next month, be sure to read our weekly e-zine, which you can get at americanhumanist.org/hnn.
And if you are new or want to hear some past episodes of Humanist Network News Podcast, you can listen to them at americanhumanist.org/hnn/podcast. You can also there read show notes from each episode, and you can get all those links that we have previously mentioned for each episode. Folks, thank you so much for listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang, and we'll talk to you next month.